Hey, New Life Gillette Church, we are thrilled you decided to listen to our teaching on your favorite podcast app. If you made a decision to follow Christ today, would you let us know by visiting yes.newlifegillette.com? Here is this week's teaching.
Yes, good morning. It is a good morning. Let me say welcome to those of you who are watching on church307.com. I saw there are a lot of you watching online today. I don't know where you're watching from, but if you could make me a s'more, that'd be great. And welcome to the guys at the prison and to our friends at the jail and those of you who are here in the room. We're starting a new series today, really creative name. Acts is the name of the series. We're just going to walk through the book of Acts. If you've ever read the book of Acts in the Bible, you know it's a long book, and so we're going to take some time. And my prayer is that by the end of the semester, you know the story of the early church way better than you do now. And so lean in, pay attention. I feel like it'll be beneficial for you because the book of Acts really is just, it's mostly narrative. It's a lot of stories about the things that happened in the early church and how you went from a small group of followers of Jesus to this massive movement that became the greatest movement in the history of the world and even today continues to grow like crazy called Christianity. But they weren't called Christians back then when they first got started. The followers of Jesus were called followers of the way. Well, Jesus is the way, so if they're going to follow Jesus, they were called followers of the way. And the word Christian early on was like a way of kind of talking negatively about that, similar to the word followers of the way. Actually, we are a part of the Methodist tradition. Methodists got our name because people were making fun of our methods. And so sometimes what initially starts as kind of like a derogatory statement about somebody eventually becomes their identity. And this is what's true about the followers of the way, the early church. Remember, Jesus claimed to be the only way to heaven. It's an exclusive claim. You try any other way, and you won't get there. You try to get to heaven by being a good person. You try to get to heaven by following any other religion or some superstition. Any other method you try will fail. There is only one way to heaven. There's only one way to the Father, and it's Jesus. The Apostle Paul said, I admit that I follow the way, which they call a cult. They're criticizing him. You're a follower of the way. I worship the God of our ancestors, talking about the Jewish people. You know, back then, most religions believed in many different gods, and they had a different God for every little part of their lives. And so to say that there is just one way, just one path, just one God was just strange in the world. And people criticized that idea. And Paul is saying, no, I gladly follow the way. And Paul in this time was being persecuted for saying that that way was Jesus. And that is the same reason why the world today rejects and hates and criticizes the Christian faith today. They want relativism. They want postmodernity. They want to just say, I can do whatever I want to do, whenever I want to do it. I'm my own person. I'm a free person. I have free will. I get to choose my way. I get to choose my path. I get to choose what is right and wrong. There's no objective truth. And so that is the fight that we're really in. Is Jesus the only way, as he claims? Or is the world right? No, whatever works for you, and that's just, we can't judge each other. We can't. No, if Jesus is right, it is an exclusivity claim. Jesus says it doesn't work any other way. Jesus told Thomas, I am the way, only way to heaven, only way to Father, the truth. There is foundational truth. We believe in absolute truth, and that truth is Jesus. And the life. If you want to live a good life, if you want to have a fulfilling life, the blessed life, you do it Jesus' way. Jesus is all three. No one can come to the Father except through Jesus. And when Jesus taught his disciples, he described to them what that way looks like. And so kind of as an introduction, we're not jumping into Acts chapter 1 yet. As an introduction to the book of Acts, I wanted to kind of bring you up to speed to what they kind of had an understanding of. They were followers of the way already as we jump into the book of Acts. So we need to describe what is the way that they were following when the movement begins. So we're going to kind of try to summarize all of what Jesus came to this world to teach us, to tell us. And I think that you can kind of imagine the path that Jesus asked each of us to walk as, or the way as a path. And on this path are some stepping stones that we each need to step on in order to fully follow the way that Jesus came into the world to introduce us to. Some of the great Christian teachers of the past have talked about these three paths that Jesus invites us to. And it appears that Jesus's way includes these three steps, these three ideas that you kind of have to come to grips with in order to fully surrender to his way. Those three stepping stones on the way are the idea that I am a sinner. The good news starts with some bad news. I got to recognize that I'm a sinner. I need a solution. Number two, Jesus is the center. It's all about him. He's the only way. And number three, my life is not about me. I can't just keep living for myself. Eventually, I will mature to, I will be sanctified and learn that my life is not about me. So let's start with step one. I need to know that I am a sinner. If I don't know that I'm not a sinner, then I do not surrender to his lordship. I do not go to him for forgiveness. I do not receive his gift of grace if I don't know that I am a sinner. G.K. Chesterton wrote this: we're all in the same boat, but we're all seasick. We are all in a boat and cannot rescue ourselves. You can't come to me in the boat and say, will you save me? Because all I can say is, I'm sorry, I'm in the boat too. We need somebody outside of our circumstances, outside of our reality, to come and rescue us from this place. We need to be saved. We need to be rescued. Question, what's a saint? The way that the world talks about is that you got to be good and you can get to heaven. And so we naturally believe that a saint is somebody is super moral. That they don't do bad things and they only do good things. Boom, you're a saint. Actually, Chesterton said this: there are saints indeed in my religion, but a saint only means a man who knows he is a sinner. That's the first step. First, I have to recognize that I'm not good enough. First, I have to recognize that I can't be good enough. You know, the Bible tells us that, you remember back in the Old Testament when God gave the laws to the Israelites, and this kind of defined how they were to act in the world, and this is what differentiated them. And he said, obey these laws. In the New Testament, we are told that the whole reason why God gave the Jews those laws was to show them that they were sinners, that they couldn't be good enough. To demonstrate to us that no matter how hard you try or how many second chances you get, you're never going to live up to the expectation of what you're supposed to live up to. And then the New Testament, the New Covenant comes along, and Jesus raises the standard. He says, you heard it said, don't murder. I'm going to raise the standard, don't even hate. You've heard, don't commit adultery. I'm going to raise the standard, don't even lust. So the standard for perfection in the New Testament, or the standard for being good enough, it seems to even get higher. He said, you're not going to get there. You're a sinner. You can't be good enough. He says, if you want to follow me, then be perfect. Good luck on that one. We have to learn that we cannot do it. And so what does that cause in us? It causes this pain, this turmoil, as I begin to wrestle with and recognize my inability to be good enough, my inability to solve my problems. And so it causes a cavern in our souls, causes anxiety and frustration and pain as we begin to wrestle with our fallen nature and the broken world that we live in. Thomas Aquinas said, the heart is restless until it rests in God. Your heart will be restless until you rest in God. Because often in this world, we feel those pains. We feel the turmoil that comes as a result of sin in the world. And so we start looking for solutions to all of our problems. And where do we look for these solutions? Here are some of the substitutes for a relationship with God. We look to wealth. Well, if I could just have enough money, then I could solve all the problems. We look to pleasure. If I could just feel that fulfillment sexually or whatever other pleasure you're looking for. Or we look for power. If I could just get things my way, I'm smart enough that I could fix everything. If I could just have control. Or we look to honor. If I could just get everybody impressed by me. If I could just be pretty enough. If I could just be respected enough, then all my problems, all my pain would go away. And when we give ourselves to one of these four pursuits, that's sin. It is in the pursuit of these things that we sin, because this is contrary to God's path. We go onto our own path, and that is what sin is. When we seek out our way rather than God's way, and in doing so, cause pain in the world. When we focus on wealth or sex or control or approval of others for our fulfillment, then what we end up doing is we center our lives on ourselves instead of God. St. John of the Cross said this, our desires, hear this, our desires are an infinite cavern that can only be filled by God. Our desires are an infinite cavern that can only be filled by God. What can fill something that is infinite? Nothing finite. In other words, nothing in this world can fill an infinite cavern. The only thing that can fill an infinite cavern is something that is infinite. And what is infinite? Only God. You can try to fill it with more sex or with more money or with more drugs, but what's going to end up happening? You just keep pouring more and more into it, and you just develop addictions. It doesn't solve any problems. It doesn't fulfill any desires. It just creates addictions. And when you first started, it would give you a little bit of a buzz for a moment. And so you thought, okay, I'm making some progress. But the buzz would wear off so fast. So you thought, okay, I just need more drugs. The little bit isn't doing it anymore. Okay, I just need more intense versions of sex. I just need larger quantities of money. And so you just pour more and more, but no matter how much you pour into the infinite cavern, it just falls in and disappears. You can pour all of Elon Musk's money and fame and whatever else he has. You put it all in the infinite cavern, and it doesn't even make a mark. You can't even find it. You can't even see it. Because the cavern is infinite. You pour everything you desire, or you think you desire in this world, into that cavern. What do you get? Disappears. It's gone. All of the power in Washington, D.C., you put it in the cavern. What do you get? Gone, nowhere. They got nothing. All the fame in Hollywood, you put it in the cavern. What do you get? Thank you. It's nothing. It disappears. It doesn't fill up an ounce of the cavern because the cavern is infinite. Can we do that math? You remember Jesus in this one scene in the Gospels is talking to a woman at the well. And this is a scandalous moment because, number one, he should not be alone with a woman. And she, to make matters worse, she's Samaritan. He's a Jew. They're like mortal enemies. But Jesus is breaking all of these cultural stereotypes, and he is sitting at a woman at the with a woman at the well, and he says this, "Everyone who drinks this water," speaking of the water in the well, "will be thirsty again." True? Have you ever taken a drink of water and you're like, well, that's the last one I'll ever need? Nope. You just got to keep going back. You're just going to keep developing more thirst. You put all the water in, you just need more. But whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them, it won't just fill up the well. The water I give them will become in them a spring. A spring produces water. A spring of water welling up to eternal life. The water he gives, the solutions he gives, the life that he gives will not just fill up the cavern, but it will overflow to the people around you. It will overflow to your friends and your family, and it will cause peace and grace in the world that you live in. That's the solution we need. Wealth and pleasure and power and honor cannot make you happy. So fill your soul with God. You need to know that you are a sinner. In fact, I would take it one step further and I'd say, don't just know that you are a sinner, know in what way you are a sinner. Name your vice. What are you tempted to try to fill the cavern with? What is the lie that you have believed that has caused you to keep going back to some sin to try to fill up a hole, to try to alleviate some pain? What causes you to sin? Is it the pursuit of wealth? Is it more pleasure? Is it a desire for fame or for power or for honor, for beauty? Name it. Because only then can you recognize that it's not going to fulfill you and you choose to run to God and away from it. All right, stepping stone number two. Number one is I am a sinner. Number two is Jesus is the center. When I was in England last month, I wasn't there last night. That'd be quite a flight. Really tired up here. No. When I was in England last month, we went to a bunch of incredible ancient buildings, and America doesn't build buildings like what you see in Europe. It's pretty crazy. And we went to these massive churches, ornate, beautiful, gold everywhere churches. And I got other thoughts about those churches, but one of the most spectacular churches that I went to was Christ Church in Oxford. It's a very famous church, largely because some of the great theologians, Christian theologians in history, preached at Christ Church in Oxford. But the reason that you might have heard of Christ Church in Oxford, it's because it's where they filmed Harry Potter, and that's way more important than all this Christian stuff, apparently. Because, like, there's two different types of tourists in this church. There's me and my pastor friends, and then 108-year-old boy and girls running around looking at the Harry Potter scenes, but as I was going through these churches all over England, I kept seeing the same thing over and over again. And one of them is in Christ Church, and it's this window that's up in top of the sanctuary. And all the churches there, the Christian churches there, have one of these windows. This one's in the sanctuary. Usually that's where they are. Sometimes they're like over the front door or something, but there's always one of these windows. And I did not know when I was there what they were. So I Googled these windows, and turns out there's a name for them. They're called rose windows. And rose windows are actually a story, a theological story that are told in each church. And they are designed very specifically to teach us a lesson. At the center of every rose window is a picture of Jesus. And then on the perimeter of the rose window, there's some kind of story. And everyone is different. The artist comes up with a story to tell a story, but the story is always a circular story. It doesn't matter where you start. You just keep telling the story over and over and over again, and it just keeps spinning. The idea of the window, the point is to teach you that you should always, in all circumstances, put Christ at the center. And if you can put Christ at the center, the wheel can spin in alignment. Everything else comes into alignment. When I make mistakes, it is because, on some level, Christ was not completely at the center. My focus had moved from the center to some other point on the wheel, and it cannot spin correctly. But when Jesus is at the center of our lives, he makes our lives better, and he makes us better at life. If we could ever get Jesus perfectly at the center of our world, what would you get? What would that be if Jesus was ever perfectly at the center? That's called heaven. Someday it's coming. Someday his kingdom will be fully established in this world. He will be at the center. He will rule. He will reign. Every knee will bow. And heaven will be here. But until then, he's not at the center. And all of the pain that you experience in your world is a result of Jesus not being at the center, both in your life and in the world around you. C.S. Lewis uses this image of a convoy of ships. And as they're sailing in unison, one of these ships gets off alignment, and what happens? Well, it bumps into the ship next to it, and it ends up causing all this chaos because these ships bump into each other as they're trying to get into alignment. I think for a better example for us would be like the Blue Angels. What happens if one of the Blue Angels gets out of alignment? Pain. Disaster. Have you ever seen how close those things fly together? Like wings almost touching each other? One of those gets out of alignment, people are dying. If you think that you can center most of your life on Jesus, but just leave a couple parts of your life that aren't aligned, where Jesus isn't the center, then those couple areas of your life that are not centered on Christ will cause pain in all the rest of your life, in all of your relationships, in all of your interactions. It doesn't happen in isolation. A mistake in one area of your life has consequences in many areas of your life, right? We know this is true. So this is what has happened in our world. Adam and Eve sinned, and it had a domino effect and caused pain in their children's life. And then their children sinned, and it compounded because now there's more of them sinning, and so it's causing more pain and more problems. And so it went on to the next generation and the next generation, and the problems just get bigger and bigger and bigger until eventually you get to our generation, where not only are we suffering the consequences of our bad actions, we're also suffering the consequences of the people around us and the consequences that were caused by Adam and Eve in the very beginning. Pain in our world, whenever Christ is not at the center, sin in our world, whenever Christ is not at the center, causes pain. Many of you have probably heard the story of Mary and Martha. Mary sat at the Lord's feet. So Mary in this story is set up as the good person. Mary sat at the Lord's feet listening to what he taught. But Martha was distracted by the big dinner that she was preparing. She came to Jesus and said, "Lord, doesn't it seem unfair to you that my sister just sits here while I do all the work? Tell her to come and help me." To which I say, amen. Mary's a jerk making Martha do all the work. Anybody else feel like that? I'm a doer. I'm the type of person that, like, if there's a task to get done, I can't think about anything else until that task is done. And so I've always read this story. When I was younger, I would read this story as if it was a competition between the contemplative lifestyle or the hardworking lifestyle. And I always read this story as if Jesus was raising up the good actions of the contemplative Mary against the bad actions of the hardworking Martha. But actually, I don't think that's the point of the story. I think, and we'll read this based on what Jesus says in a second, I think it's more about our focus, not the type of thing we are called to do. It's not a comparison of the values of hard work and contemplation. It's about being focused, singularly minded, centered, aligned. "Martha, Martha," the Lord answered, "you are worried and upset about many things, but few things are needed, or indeed, actually, only one thing. You need focus. You need to prioritize." This is about the problem of the one and the many. If you are too scattered, if you are not focused, if you are out of alignment, then pain is going to result. The thing Mary did that was right was she put Jesus first above everything else. If we want to live the good life that Jesus called us to live, then God has to be in the center. In the gospel, we read a few stories of Jesus having interactions with demons. Here's a demon-possessed people. Here's one of them. A man in the synagogue who was possessed by an impure spirit cried out, "What do you want with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are." It's a diss here. "You're the Holy One of God." Here's one person, but he's using plural pronouns. Why? There's another one of these stories of Jesus interacting with a man possessed by demons. This time he casts a bunch of demons into some pigs. Then Jesus demanded, "What is your name?" And he replied, "My name is Legion, because there are many of us inside this man." The word diabolic literally means to scatter. It is this lack of focus, this lack of alignment with God that causes the pain in our world. That is what tempts us. That when we believe that we should be following God, we get distracted by all the other things and we get out of alignment with God because, ooh, that looks pretty, or I want that, or that's kind of cool, or I'm jealous of that person and I want what she has. And we get out of alignment. That's what causes us to sin. And what God is inviting us to is a singular focus into alignment with Him. One of the most famous rose windows in the world is in the church in Cambridge. And this rose window in Cambridge has a very famous name. It's called, anybody want to guess? The Wheel of Fortune. You've heard of it, I guess? This window tells a cool story. So as always, you got Jesus in the center of the window. But at the top of the window, you've got this guy who's powerful, wealthy, good-looking, everything's going perfect for this guy. But then about here in the window, some bad things start happening in his life, and he comes upon some hard times, and he makes some mistakes. And then over here, he is just kind of stumbling out of control. This picture on the right side is him just upside down. He's just lost control of his life. And so he's slowly losing everything that he has. And by the time you get to the bottom of the window, he is a beggar, homeless, poor, no power. Until he starts working and has a couple breakthroughs and a couple successes and wins some battles, and he begins to rise up again until eventually he's risen back to power. But what happens when you get here? The story just happens again. The wheel continues to turn. The pain continues to come. And when we're up on top, we like how it feels sometimes. And so we start thinking, well, if I could just get higher, then I would have even less pain. But then when we're on the bottom, all we can focus on is, well, if I could just get to the top, then I would be okay. What's the solution to the spinning on the wheel? Don't center your life on the edge. Don't find your identity on the edge of the wheel. Don't find your identity in your circumstances. You have to look outside of your circumstances. You can't look at your identity based on the situation that you're in, or based on the category that you're in, or based on your success or failure in life, or your beauty, or your whatever it is. That can't be your identity. Because what happens when you get centered on the edge of the wheel? This is what happens.
Oh, there we go.
Oh, man.
Can anybody relate? Anybody been there? Yeah, when you were a kid, you rode merry-go-rounds. You'd sit on the edge and you'd try so hard to hang on, but if you got anybody with any strength on the outside spinning that thing, you were not holding on. Is it inertia? Is that what that's called? It's just too powerful. It throws you off. So where do you want to be? Right in the middle. If you get right in the middle, then your balance can allow you to stay there. That's our goal, is to get back to the middle. Because the one on the edge, that's a hard life. John Lennon. John Lennon was not a Christian. Imagine there's no heaven, right? That guy. John Lennon, especially in the early heydays of the Beatles, said that the Beatles were bigger than Jesus. But later in life, he wrote this. He said, I'm just sitting here watching the wheels go round and round. I really love to watch them roll. No longer riding, I love to watch them as if he's on the outside now. He's moved above this spinning of life. No longer riding on the merry-go-round. I just had to let it go. It wasn't working. I was riding that wheel, and it just caused pain, and it was hard, and I couldn't do it, and I couldn't find success. How does John Lennon feel like he's not on top? Because he knows. I mean, music industry, up and down, in and out, popular, not popular. This is why rich people are always depressed. They're living life on the edge of the wheel. What was it like for John Lennon when he was super rich and famous and everything was going well for him? What was it like for him? I'll give you a hint. Help, I need somebody, help. Anybody sing it? Not just anybody, help. Won't you please, please help me, help me. Sound like a guy who's got it all together? This is a guy at the top of his game, begging for help, looking for answers, realizing that his way is not working. It doesn't matter how rich and powerful you are. Only God can fill the hole in your soul that needs to be filled. I'm really sorry if all my illustrations today are English illustrations. I wrote this sermon while I was in England and got into English culture for a while. It was a good trip. Okay, so let's review. Three steps, three stepping stones on the way. I am a sinner. I need somebody outside of myself to save me. I put Jesus at the center of my life. And when I do those things, a sanctification process happens, a maturing process happens, and my life becomes no longer about me. In ancient cultures, we see a common initiation ritual. And in different cultures, in ancient cultures, they would do this in different ways. But boys usually would have to go through these very difficult steps in order to transition from child to man. And so to transition them, they would rip them from their homes, not to transition them like the world would say that. I mean to transition from young to old. They would rip them from the homes where they had been coddled by their parents. They had been taken care of. They had been protected. They had been fed. And when you live in that situation, I just ask my kids, over time, they start to believe that they are the center of the world, right? And everything is about them. So wise parents begin a process of helping them to see, actually, if you always put yourself at the center, you're just going to have pain. Your life is going to be really hard. And so what is the solution to this problem of putting myself at the center? Well, usually in these cultures, they would call it a rite of passage. And at home, their mom made them the center of attention, but they are taken from their homes. They are taught how to become a productive citizen. First, they're taught the uniquenesses of their culture and what it means to be a part of their community. And then they are sent out into the wilderness to go fight some big battle or discover God or something like that. And then if they were successful in the wilderness, then they could come home and take their place as a contributing member of society, as a man. What's their goal? Really, the ultimate goal of this whole process is to help them see that my life is not about me. Our world wants us to set our kids loose and tell them, go discover yourself. Go create yourself. But what Christians we really need to do is not to set our kids loose to discover themselves. We set our kids loose to recognize that they need the community. That it is better in the community. It is better when we fellowship together, when we support each other, when we each play our part. We set them loose, not so that they are separated permanently. We set them loose so that they can come back and recognize the value of having a community of committed people who are committed to making, to participating in something that is bigger than them, is better than them, is more powerful than they are on their own. Paul says to the church in Ephesus, all glory to God who is able. I'm not able. He is able, through his mighty power at work within us, to accomplish infinitely more than we might ask or think. Our brains aren't big enough. Our willpower is not great enough. Our power is not strong enough, but God is. And if we will put him at the center, rather than being scattered and going after all the wealth and the power and the honor for ourselves, then what we will end up doing is contributing to something that is worth investing in. And when we just focus on ourselves, we just waste our lives. We just waste away. And we're going to get to the end of the life and we're just going to be depressed. What was the purpose? I'm 40 years old now and my life is just, my body's just deteriorating, right? I'm really, like a lot, too much. It's painful. And you start getting this point, you're just like, what do I do that's more than just deteriorate until I go to the grave? What can I invest in that will go on past my life? I want to be a part of something that's bigger than I am. So you got to pick something, right? You got to pick something to invest in. You're going to get to that point. And you're going to ask, what's worth investing in? So then you got to pick. To which Jesus says, I am the way. Only one way. Joseph Campbell said, there is perhaps nothing worse than reaching the top of a ladder and discovering that you're on the wrong wall. The world's ladder of success is taking you up the wrong wall. So what ladder are you climbing? Give yourself to God. Don't get to the end of your life regretting the things that you prioritized, regretting the things that you valued. Center your life on him. This is what it means to be people of the way. And you are invited. Jesus Christ died on the cross so that your sin could be forgiven, so that you can live in eternal relationship with him. So the invitation to the way is a free gift. All you have to do is say yes. I'll walk that path. I'll go with you. Just say yes. And then he has promised to sanctify us, to grow us, to mature us, to help us to become the people he created us to be. God, I thank you for your way. I pray that you will give us the courage to step out in faith and to follow you when it is contrary to what we feel, and to follow you when it's contrary to what our community is telling us we should do, that we would be countercultural in the right kind of way. We love you and thank you. In Jesus' name, amen.